And it is just about midnight. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial, WBAI in New York City, 99.5 on the FM dial, streaming at WBAI.org. Coming up next, an edition of A Mansion for the Rat, not heard since, come on, February 4th. Well, it has been heard once since February 4th, 2020, but that was the original broadcast date. And here it comes again with all new phone numbers for pitching, inserted diligently by yours truly, who will be here in about an hour with a program as yet to be determined, known as the Dustbin of History. Maybe I'll just play three Gene Shepherd shows and go home. We were supposed to be preempted tonight for a Nakba 24-hour special. That will actually begin on WBAI at 6 a.m. So if you were looking forward to that, it's coming. It's just not coming until the overnight is done. A Mansion for the Rat with Anne-Marie Hendrickson.
It is Tuesday night in New York City, a little after midnight, on a rainy night in New York City. You are listening to WBAI FM 99.5, part of the Pacifica Radio Network. My name is Anne-Marie Hendrickson, and the name of this show is A Mansion for the Rat. And tonight, I'm going to be continuing my readings and talking about folklore of the rat, people's relationships and think feelings and legends and stories around rats, relations between rats and people in celebration of this year of the rat. And Before I do that, though, what time is it, kids? It's fun drive time. That's right. You look forward to it every couple of months, don't you? Of course you do. A time when we ask you, our listeners, to help us pay the bills around here, since we don't get funding in any other way to do that. We rely on you for everything. And so I ask you to call. We all ask you to call 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Or go to our website at WBAI.org. Click on the Fund Drive box that you will find, scrolling across our very front page. And there will be many ways that you can donate directly online through there, either through our online website or you can text with your phone. There are a few ways of doing it. And again, that's WBAI.org. You know, just pledge because you know that this programming is not something that you will hear anywhere else, will you? If we had to pay for it in normal ways, we would not be able to do what we do because we couldn't get away with it. And in these weird-ass times when all kinds of other, media sources seem to be getting away with all kinds of stuff, don't you want us to be able to get away with what we do? Of course you do. And we can only do that if you give us money to stay on the air. So please do call 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Or go to WBAI.org. Now, what I would really urge you to do, what I wish you would do, I wish you would become a buddy of my show. Become a buddy of any show, but come on, you're listening to me. Become a buddy of my show. Be a pal. You agree to donate a minimum of $10 a month, which is deducted automatically from your credit card, from your bank account, from your debit card. And then you know you've given it to us, so when I go through, pitch a fits like this over the course of the next year, you don't even think about it because you've already done your part. You're already supporting us. And, of course, we get the money, so we don't freak out every fund drive wondering if we're going to get enough money to keep the lights on, pay for the electricity for this fabulous new broadcasting studio that we just spent all this money, putting in so that it can finally work like kind of a regular radio station. Again, keep all this great programming on the air and coming out to you. And again, 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. That's the call center. They'll be thrilled to hear from you. Trust. And or you could go to WBAI.org and just follow the directions from there. And before I get into my rat programming, my only comment on this Iowa caucus stuff is, for you technophiles that always give me a hard time, I mean, if you don't want crabby, irritable, boomer, technophobe Luddites like me, bitching at everybody to, stop trying to oversell me on, this brave new world of everybody staring into their phone 24 hours a day and, blah, 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 blah. Hell, I'm kind of, it's an argument I'm bored with making myself. But then when you just hand me a fiasco like happened today, with this app that just, malfunctions so spectacularly. it used to be if you really wanted to mess up election, it took some work, You had to have a cadre of guys, You had to have boots on the ground. They had to go and, steal ballots. They had to, dump them in the river, They had to go threaten people, and they had to pay off voters. Yeah, now you just need some, bored, underpaid tech workers sitting in a room in some other state to blow the whole thing up and, to send the whole thing just, careening off the rails. Oh, God, this whole, it's like we're, enthralled to a cargo cult that keeps dropping these boxes of exploding cigars out of the plane, and then they just blow up on our faces, you know. And yet we still keep waiting for the plane to bring more exploding cigars, if not worse. You know, I'm trying to be lighthearted about this. Well, anyhow, be that as it may, better informed people than me are going to cover this heavily on this station, I'm sure. I have already, you know, been covering, we'll be talking about it in the morning. As you know, and which is exactly why you listen to us, and I'm going to remind you, 212-209-2950 or WBAI.org. You know you need to fund us in times like this when you know you're only going to get sort of what's happening from tuning in to WBAI. You know it, and I know it. But for the moment, what do you say we go back, way back, to a time, an awful time, a cruel time, a time as cruel as ours, where farmers and tenants and serfs and working people were screwed over, had everything taken from them, and the people who took it blamed the poor for not having enough money to buy what they needed. That's right, a time like ours, but not our time, this time being 10th century Germany. And what's this got to do with rats? Well, one of the most famous rat stories is based originally sort of, the famous Bishop Hatto, and how he came to be eaten by a bunch of rats. I'll get to approximating the source material a little later, but the first thing I'm going to read is a very famous poem. Probably the reason that the poem that most people associate with this story. And it's called God's Judgment on a Wicked Bishop by Robert Southey, which was published in 1799 at a time in England when, This story of rich landowners forcing people off the land and forcing them into penury and death was, you know, a familiar story in England as well. And Southey has sort of, well, I mean, I think he has a better reputation than he had probably when I was younger. He had a reputation for a very long time as someone who just went, you know, was somebody who was a firebrand in the 1790s when he wrote this poem, and then, you know, became the poet laureate in 1813 and moved to the right. That's true generally, but I think he moved more to the center. I think one of the things that has sort of like improved Southey's reputation is that I think until Richard Holmes' two-volume biography of Samuel Taylor Coleridge that came out, whenever it came out, I don't know, a while ago, like 20, 25 years ago, that it was, Coleridge just became such a terrifying fire-breathing right-winger. I mean, way farther to the right than any of these people, that Southey and all these others looked pretty good in comparison. Because up to that point, Coleridge had kind of gotten a pass, mostly because people hadn't read a lot of the stuff that he wrote for the right-wing rags later in his life. But be that as it may, this is Robert Southey when he was young and unambiguously a man of the left. And it's God's Judgment on a Wicked Bishop. The summer and autumn had been so wet that in winter the corn was growing yet. 'Twas a piteous sight to see all round the grain lie rotting on the ground. Every day the starving poor crowded around Bishop Hatto's door, for he had a plentiful last year's store, and all the neighborhood could tell his granaries were furnished well. At last Bishop Hatto appointed a day to quiet the poor without delay. He bade them to his great barn repair, and they should have food for the winter there. Rejoice, such tidings good to hear, the poor folk flocked from far and near. The great barn was full as it could hold of women and children and young and old. Then when he saw it could hold no more, Bishop Hatto made fast the door. For while for mercy on Christ they call, he set fire to the barn and burnt them all. "If faith 'tis an excellent bonfire," quoth he, "and the country is greatly obliged to me for ridding it in these times forlorn of rats that only consume the corn." So then to his palace returned he, and he sat down to supper merrily. And he slept that night like an innocent man. But Bishop Hatto never slept again. In the morning, as he entered the hall, where his picture hung against the wall, a sweat like death all o'er him came, for the rats had eaten it out of the frame. As he looked, there came a man from his farm. He had a countenance white with alarm. "My lord, I opened your granaries this morn, and the rats had eaten all your corn." Another came running presently, and he was pale as pale could be. "Fly, my lord bishop, fly," quoth he. 10,000 rats are coming this way. The Lord forgive you for yesterday." "I'll go to my tower on the Rhine," replied he. "'Tis the safest place in Germany. The walls are high, and the shores are steep, and the stream is strong, and the water deep." Bishop Hatto fearfully hastened away, and he crossed the Rhine without delay, and reached his tower, and barred with care all the windows, doors, and loopholes there. He laid him down, and he closed his eyes, but soon a scream made him arise. He started, and saw two eyes of flame on his pillow from whence the screaming came. He listened and looked. It was only the cat. And the bishop, he grew more fearful for that, for she sat screaming, mad with fear, at the army of rats that were drawing near. "For they have swum over the river so deep, and they have climbed the shores so steep, and up the tower their way is bent, to do the work for which they were sent. They are not to be told by the dozen or score. By thousands they come, and by myriads and more. Such numbers had never been heard of before. Such a judgment had never been witnessed of yore." Down on his knees the bishop fell, and faster his beads did he tell, as louder and louder drawing near, the gnawing of their teeth he could hear. And in at the windows, and in at the door, and through the walls, helter-skelter they pour, and down from the ceiling and up through the floor, from the right and the left, from behind and before, from within and without, from above and below, and all at once to the bishop they go. They have whetted their teeth against the stones, and now they pick the bishop's bones. They gnawed the flesh from every limb, for they were sent to do judgment on him. Wow, there's some 1790s goth for you. I mean, could EC Comics have done it any better? As I said, this is an old story, an old legend, and I'm going to read from Sevin Bjerngold a couple of minutes, giving some of the other versions of the story and other origins of the story. But this version of it, I believe, you know, had a big influence on some of the other people that wrote similar stories later. I mean, the most obvious one, the best known one probably, especially to listeners to this show and to the show that follows, The Dustbin of History, would be H.P. Lovecraft's story, The Rats in the Walls, adapted many times. But this idea of somebody being punished that way is an old European legend. And as I said, it's interesting. This is not a rat's revenge story, interestingly enough. This is where rats are avenging injuries done to the people that they live with. The rats are standing up for the humans. They're going and taking out a villain who oppressed them. You know, they're going up and standing up for the people, which I think seems odd and hard to understand us. Also, I mean, again, I'll, you know, mention, as I've mentioned before, that there is no distinction between mouse and rat in most European languages. It's certainly not in the forms of German in which this story first came down. So that the place, and I mean, there is the place where this allegedly took place on along the Rhine, the tower that where the rats supposedly attacked the man is actually to this day called the Mouse Tower, because they, you know, that's mice that did it, mice that went in and killed a guy. And I think it has a lot to do with the ideas that, again, that mice and rats are associated with, you know, plenty and leftovers, you know, having enough grain to share. And then in some way, these animals with which we share our world, I mean, even biologists refer to them as inquilines, you know, tenants, our neighbors, that perhaps we could be seen as sharing more with them than we really want to see. And here's the story. As I said, here's a story where the rats actually go and, you know, avenge the deaths of the people, of the poor people against the rich people. Okay, and the next section that I'm going to read some selections from a book called The Curious Myths of the Middle Ages, put together by Sabine Baring-Gould, who, despite the name Sabine, was actually a guy. From a, you know, I guess a lower aristocratic family in England. I don't know what exactly describe what he was. But he was a curate and spent his life collecting folklore and mythology, and quite a lot of it. And I will just read this through mostly without comment, I guess, except I will just point out that some of the ideas that they had about, that everything in, old European, pagan and, medieval life had to do with fertility of the crops and, bringing the harvest in, and somehow this required people going out and having massive amounts of sex in the field, or maybe gang raping a couple of chicks, or killing a few guys. You know, you could put a guy in a big wicker van and set him on fire, all that kind of idea. And this kind of idea is interesting, partially because it sort of made it really continued in neo-pagan, ritual life, right up, almost to the present day, really. It still does, even though it's been, discredited for the most part, or at least, not totally. I mean, I'd say it doesn't play a role, but it doesn't play near the big role that I could probably see to people like in the Victorian era. Anyhow, if you read anything like this or the Golden Bough, this is sort of, it's a given. It's a fundamental, assumption of the work. But it is interesting. I mean, as I said, I'm going to read this to you, and it's there's a whole bunch that's interesting how many sources there are for this particular legend of the avenging rats. Of the many who yearly visit the Rhine and bring away with them reminiscences of tottering castles and desecrated convents, whether they take an interest or not in the legends inseparably attached to these ruins, none probably have failed to learn and remember the famous story of God's judgment on the wicked Bishop Hatto in the quaint Maelstrom, erected on a little rock in midstream, Maelstrom being Mouse Tower. Did I mention this is written 1864 is when this book came out? Sorry, I don't know if I mentioned it before. At the close of the 10th century lived Hatto, once abbot of Fulda, where he ruled the monks with great prudence for 12 years, and afterwards bishop of Mayence. In the year 970, Germany suffered from famine. Weakened by the cries of the famishing people, the bishop appointed a day whereupon he took to undertook to quiet them. He bade all who were without bread or the means to purchase it at its then high rate repair to his great barn. From all quarters, far and near, the poor, hungry folk flocked into Kalb and were admitted into the barn till it was as full of people as it could be made to contain. Then there came a man to him from his farm, with a countenance pale with fear, to tell him that the rats had devoured all the corn in his granaries. And presently there came another servant to him, inform him that a legion of rats was on its way to his palace. The bishop looked from his window, saw the roads and fields dark with the moving multitude. Neither hedge nor wall impeded their progress as they made straight for his mansion. Then, full of terror, the prelate fled by his postern and, taking a boat, was rowed out to his tower in the river. And then all the events take place that we already read about in the poem. It is satisfactory to know that popular fiction has maligned poor Bishop Hatto, who was not by any means a hard-hearted or wicked prelate. Yes, says you. Wolfius, who tells the story on the authority of Honorius, Augusto Donensis, Marianus Scotus, and Grithemius, accompanying it with a curious picture which is reproduced on the opposite page. This is a picture of rats climbing up into a tower. It's a pretty cool picture, actually. Says, this is regarded by many as a fable, yet the tower, taking its name from the mice, exists to this day in the River Rhine. But there is no evidence, as there is documentary proof, that the tower was erected as a station for collecting tolls on the vessels which passed up and down on the river. And the same story is told of other persons and places. Now, to me, my interest in the story is not whether it really happened or not, but the idea that it would. The idea that nature itself, even lowly rats and mice, would be so appalled by the genocidal behavior of a rich man that they would come to human the aid of their fellow sentient beings. They would come to the aid of the humans. That even though it's fiction, the story it's telling is telling a story that all of us know really is true. Oh, where am I? And here is a picture of Bishop Haddam in the Mass Tower to do service as an illustration of the dreadful death of Widerhoff, Bishop of Strasbourg, 997, who in the 17th year of his episcopate, on July 17th, and in punishment for having suppressed the convent of Selsen on the Rhine, was also attacked or devoured by mice or rats. And the same fate is also attributed to Bishop Adolf of Cologne, who died in 1112. The story comes to us from Switzerland. Freiherr von Gütigen possessed three castles between Konstanz and Arbonne in the canton of Thurgau, namely Göttingen, Mosburg, and Oberburg. During a famine, he collected the poor of his territory into a great barn, and there consumed them, mocking their cries by exclamations of, "Hark, how the rats and mice are squeaking!" Shortly after, he was attacked by an army of mice and fled to his castle of Göttingen, in the waters of the Lake of Konstanz, but the vermin pursued him to his retreat and devoured him. The castle then sank into the lake, and its ruins are distinguishable when the water is clear and unruffled. In Austria, a similar legend is related of the Mouse Tower at Holzolster, with this difference only, that the hard-hearted nobleman casts the poor people into a dungeon and starves them to death instead of burning them. Between Inning and Seefeld in Bavaria is Worthsee, called also the Mouse Lake. There was once also a count of Seefeld, who in time of famine put all his starving poor into a dungeon, jested at their cries, which he called the squeaking of mice, and was devoured by these animals in his tower in the lake, to which he fled for them, although he suspended his bed by iron chains from the roof. A similar story is told of the Mouse Schloss in the Hirschberger Lake. A Polish version occurs in old historical writers. Martinus Gallus, who wrote in 1110, says that King Popiel, having been driven from his kingdom, was so tormented by mice that he fled to an island, whereon was a wooden tower in which he took refuge. But the host of mice and rats swam over and ate him up. The story is told more fully by Majolus. When the Poles murmured at the bad government of the king and sought redress, Popiel summoned the chief murmurers to his palace, where he pretended that he was ill, and then poisoned them. After this, the corpses were flung by his orders into the lake Gopalo. Then the king held a banquet of rejoicing at having freed himself from these troublesome complainers. But during the feast, by a strange metamorphosis, an enormous number of mice issued from the bodies of his poisoned subjects, and rushing on the palace, attacked the king and his family. Popiel took refuge within a circle of fire, but the mice broke through the flaming ring. Then he fled with his wife and child to a castle in the sea, but was followed by the animals and devoured by them. A Scandinavian legend is to this effect. King Canute the Saint was murdered by the Earl Asbjorn in the Church of St. Alban in Odense during an insurrection of the Jules in 1086. Next year, the country suffered severely from famine, and this was attributed to divine vengeance for the murder of the king. Asbjorn was fallen upon by rats and eaten up. William of Malmesbury tells this story. I have heard a person of the utmost veracity relate that one of the adversaries of Henry IV of Germany, a weak and factious man, while reclining at a banquet, was on a sudden so completely surrounded by mice as to be unable to escape. So great was the number of these little animals that there could scarcely be imagined more in a whole province. It was in vain that they were attacked with clubs and fragments of the benches which were at hand. And though they were for a long time assailed by all, yet they wreaked their deputed curse on no one else, pursuing him only with their teeth and with a kind of dreadful squeaking. And though he was carried out to sea... Oh, where am I? Why am I losing my place? And though he was carried out to sea about a javelin's cast by the servants, yet he could not by these means escape their violence, For immediately so great a multitude of mice took to the water that you would have sworn the sea was strewed with chaff. But when they began to gnaw the planks of the ship, and the water, rushing through the chinks, threatened inevitable shipwreck, the servants turned the vessel to the shore. The animals, then also swimming close to the ship, landed first. Thus the wretch, set on shore, and soon after entirely gnawed in pieces, satiated the dreadful hunger of the mice. And I will take a little break just long enough to tell you that you are listening to WBAI-FM in New York City, 99.5, part of the Pacifica Radio Network. My name is Anne-Marie Henriksen. The name of this show is A Mansion for the Rat, and I am reading to you from a book of folklore called Curious Myths of the Middle Ages, compiled by Sabine Beringold and published in 1864. And I'm reading this because I'm presenting to you. I'll be presenting to you for a little while, probably next week, too. I'll keep this going for as long as I can come up with something. Myths and Folklore of the Rat, one of my favorite animals. That's the name of my show, and done celebrating it in this year of the rat. And I also take time to remind you that we are in Fund Drive, folks. We still need money, so please do remember to call 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Go to WBAI.org and find the many ways that you can donate there to keep this long, crazily idealistic project called Pacifica Radio on the air. And please also, I would like you to become a buddy, be a pal, be a friend of my show, which you do by going to WBAI.org and agreeing to donate $10 a month, a minimum of $10 a month. But hell, sky's the limit. Come on, be a pal. Be a sport. And then you would just say, we'll just be automatically deducted from your bank account, your credit card, your debit card, and we'll get money. We'll get money to keep things going, even when we're not in Fund Drive. And maybe the fund drives will be shorter if we do it that way. Certainly, that's our hope. And we really, really, it's really, really works well for us to keep the money coming in all the time. That I'll tell you. But back to the story of the avenging mice, the many, many legends of the avenging mice, who chew people to pieces if they are oppressive and greedy. Okay, to return back to the story of the guy who got chased on an island and eaten by the mice. I deem this the less wonderful because it's well known that in Asia, if a leopard bite any person, a party of mice approach directly. But if, by the care of servants driving them off, the destruction can be avoided during 9 days, then medical assistance, if called in, may be of service. My informant had seen a person wounded after this manner who, despairing of safety on shore, proceeded to sea and lay at anchor, when immediately more than 1,000 mice swam out. Wonderful to relate, in the rinds of pomegranates, the insides of which they had eaten, but they were drowned through the loud shouting of the sailors. This idea of the mice and the pomegranates has so much... there's so much symbolic baggage with everything, anything having to do with a pomegranate, which is, of course, a symbol of royalty throughout this time period. And, you know, if you've ever seen a pomegranate, you can see why. It's this gorgeous red color. It has a little crown, which if you buy them in the store around here, you know, they don't have it. It's all busted off. And when you open it up, of course, the seeds look like jewels, which is why usually, you know, in a lot of medieval Christian statues, they'll be holding one. They'll be holding a pomegranate in their hand. It's a sign of kinghood, of royalty. And also, it's also what Persephone, you know, made the big mistake of eating, you know, 6 pomegranate seeds when she went down to Hades. So there's a lot. So mice floating over the sea in the rinds of pomegranates that's a great image to me. Going out to get the guy. Albertus Triumphantium tells the same story under the year 1083, quoting probably from William of Malmesbury. Herodotus Cambrensis, who died in 1220, in his itinerary relates a curious story of a youth named Cecilius Escherhir, or Longshanks, who was attacked in his bed by multitudes of toads and who fled from them to the top of a tree, but was pursued by the reptiles and his flesh picked from his bones. And in like manner, he adds, we read of how by the secret but never unjust counsel of God, a certain man was persecuted by the larger sort of mice, which are commonly called rat. And Theotmar of Merseburg, who was born in 976 and died in 1018, says that there was once a certain knight who, having appropriated the goods of St. Clement and refused to make restitution, was one day attacked by an innumerable host of mice as he lay in bed. At first he defended himself with a club, then with his sword, and as he found himself unable to cope with the multitude, he orders his servants to put him in a box and suspend this by a rope from the ceiling, and as soon as the mice were gone, to liberate him. But the animals pursued him even thus, and when he was taken down, it was found that they had eaten the flesh and the skin off of his bones. And thus it became manifest to all how obnoxious to God is the sin of sacrilege. Caesarius of Hesterbach tells of a usurer in Cologne who, moved with compunction for his sins, confessed to a priest who bade him fill a chest with bread as alms for the poor attached to the church of St. Gerion. Next morning the loaves were found transformed into toads and frogs. Behold, said the priest, the value of your alms in the sight of God. To which the terrified usurer replied, Lord, what shall I do? And the priest answered, if you wish to be saved, lie this night naked amidst these reptiles. One is contrition. He, though he recoiled from such a couch, preferred to lie among worms which perish, rather than those which are eternal, and he cast himself nude upon the creatures. Then the priest went to the box, shut it, and departed, which, when he opened it on the following day, he found to contain nothing except human bones. It will be seen from these versions of the Haddo myth how prevalent among the northern nations was the idea of men being devoured by vermin. The manner of accounting for their death differs, but all the stories agree in regarding that death as mysterious. I believe the origin of these stories to be a heathen human sacrifice made in times of famine. There we go. There we go with this, you know, golden bough thing again, you know. Well, I'll just let it go. I mean, I already said what I think. I think the origin of it, I think the reason for this is a little different from that. That such sacrifice took place among the Scandinavian Teutonic peoples is certain. Tacitus tells us that the Germans sacrificed men. Snorre Sturluson gives us an instance of the Swedes offering their king to obtain abundant crops. I'm not saying I don't agree. I don't think that people. Many peoples around the world have practiced human sacrifice for various reasons. I just the mouse rat thing is really the interesting part to me, and I don't think that has much to do with human sacrifice. Actually, I think it has to do with something else. I think it has to do with the way that people regard rats and what their role is in the world. Cleaning things up, for one thing. Back to the text, which is, of course, as I mentioned before, I'll mention again, this is a collection of, legends and stories called Curious Myths of the Middle Ages, compiled by Sabine Baring Gould in 1864. Donald took the heritage after his father Visbor had and ruled over the land. Let me go back to the introduction again, since I've sort of interrupted the story and confused you and myself, frankly. Snorre Sturluson, who died in 1241, gives us an instance of the Swedes offering their king to obtain abundant crops. Donald took the heritage after his father Visbur and ruled over the land. As in his time there was a great famine and distress, the Swedes made great offerings of sacrifice at Uppsala. The first autumn they sacrificed oxen, but the succeeding season was not improved by it. The following autumn they sacrificed men, but the succeeding year was rather worse. The third autumn, when the offer of sacrifices should begin, a great multitude of Swedes came to Uppsala. And now the chiefs held consultations with each other, and all agreed that the times of scarcity were on account of their king, Donald, and they resolved to offer him for good reasons, and to assault and to kill him, and to sprinkle the altar of the gods with his blood. And they did so. So again with Olaf the tree feller. There came dear times and famine, which they ascribed to their king, as the Swedes use always to reckon good or bad crops for or against their kings. The Swedes took it amiss that Olaf was sparing in his sacrifices and believed the dear times must proceed from this cause. The Swedes therefore gathered together troops, made an expedition against King Olaf, surrounded his house, and burnt him in it, giving him to Odin as a sacrifice for good crops. Or maybe just getting a jerk out of the way. I mean, does he really need to be a human sacrifice? He's just a, you know, he could be impeached, for example, like some other Donalds, to get him out of the way. Saxo Grammaticus says that in the reign of King Sneo of Denmark, there was a famine. The Chronicon Regum Danicorum tells a curious story about this Sneo being devoured by vermin, sent to destroy him by his former master, the giant Lei. Probably Sneo was sacrificed, like Donald or Olaf, to obtain good harvests. The manner in which human sacrifices were made was very different. Sometimes the victims were precipitated off a rock, sometimes hung, and at other times they were sunk in a bog. It seems probable to me that the manner in which an offering was made for plenty was by exposure to rats. Just as Monsieur de Chaloux tells us, an African tribe placed their criminals in the way of ants to be devoured by them. The peculiar death of Ragnar Lodbrog, who was sentenced by Ella of Northumberland to be stung to death by serpents in a dungeon, was somewhat similar. Offering to rats and mice are still prevalent among the peasantry in certain parts of Germany, if we may credit Grimm and Wolf, and this can only be a relic of heathenism, for the significance of the act is lost. And again, I think this is an inefficient way of getting rid of a body. Personally, I don't think that's why people would offer up anything to rats or mice. The offerings are made to rats in India, as I talked about last week, as everyone knows, and I don't think they're as interested in stripping human bodies as, you know, they might be in these stories. It says something else is going on. In Denmark, it is said that the elves appear in Yuletide as mice, and cakes are laid out for them. In Bohemia, on Christmas Eve, the remainder of the supper is given them with the words, "Mice, eat of these crumbs and leave the wheat." Now, see, that makes more sense to me. Just share. Share with them. Don't be greedy. There's enough for everybody. If I am correct in supposing that the Haddo myth points to sacrifices of chieftains and princes in times of famine, and that the manner of offering the sacrifice was the exposure of the victim to rats, then it is not to be wondered at that, when the reason of such a sacrifice was forgotten, the death should be accounted as a judgment of God for some crime committed by the sufferer as hard-heartedness, murder, or sacrilege. Both Gerardus Cambrensis and William of Malmesbury are, however, sadly troubled to find a cause. Rats and mice have generally been considered sacred animals. This isn't me talking, by the way. This is Beringold's stage, that rats and mice are generally considered sacred animals. Among the Scandinavian Teutonic peoples, they were regarded as the souls of the dead. In the article on the Piper of Hamelin, which I'm not going to discuss tonight, that has such a big thing around it, I'm going to leave that to a separate show. I mentioned that Pretorius gives a story of a woman's soul leaving her body in the shape of a red mouse. According to Bohemian belief, one must not go to sleep thirsty, or the soul will leave the body in search of drink. Three laborers once lost their way in a wood. Parched with thirst, they sought, but in vain, for a spring of water. At last one of them lay down and fell asleep, but the others, continuing their search, discovered a fountain. They drank, and then returned to their comrade. He still slept. And they observed a little white mouse run out of his mouth, go to the spring, drink, and return into his mouth. They woke him and said, "You are such an idle fellow that instead of going yourself after water, you sent your soul. We will have nothing more to do with you." A miller in the Black Forest, after having cut wood, lay down and slept. A servant saw a mouse run out of him. He and his companions went in pursuit. They scared the little creature away, little thinking it was the soul of the miller, and they were never able to rouse him again. Paulus Diaconus retells of King Guntram that his soul left his body in the shape of a serpent, and Hugh Miller in his Schools and Schoolmasters tells a Scottish story of two companions, one of whom slept, whilst the other watched. He who was awake saw a bee come out of the mouth of the sleeper, cross a stream of water on a straw, run into a hole, then return and disappear into the mouth of his friend. These are similar stories, but the bee and the serpent have taken the place of the mouse. The idea that the soul is like a mouse lies at the root of several grotesque stories, such as those told by Martin Luther in his Table Talk, of a woman giving birth to a rat, and that of a mother harassed by the clamor of her children wishing they were mice, and finding this inconsiderate wish to be literally fulfilled. The same idea has passed into Christian iconography. According to the popular German belief, the souls of the dead spend the first night after they leave the body with St. Gertrude, the second with St. Michael, and the third in their descent habitation. St. Gertrude is regarded as the patroness of fleeting souls, the saint who is the first to shelter the spirits when they begin their wandering. As the patroness of souls, her symbol is a mouse. Various stories have been invented to account for this symbol. Some relate that a maiden span upon her festival, and the mouse ate through her clue as a punishment. A prettier story is that when she prayed, she was so absorbed that the mice ran about her and up her pastoral staff without attracting her attention. Another explanation is that the mouse is a symbol of an evil spirit, which St. Gertrude overcame. But St. Gertrude occupies the place of the ancient Teutonic goddess Holda, or Proshta, who was the receiver of the souls of maidens and children, and who still exists as the White Lady, not infrequently in German legends, transforming herself, or those who she decoys into her home, into white mice. It is not unlikely that the saying that rats desert a falling house applied originally to the crumbling ruin of the body from which the soul fled. In the Hatto and Popiel legends, it is evident that the rats are the souls of those whom the bishop and the king murdered. Yes, now we're getting more to the point. The rats of Bingen issue from the flames in which the poor people are being consumed. The same is said of the rats which devoured the Freiherr of Göttingen. The rats come from the corpses of those poisoned by Popiel. There is a curious Icelandic story written in the 12th century which bears a striking resemblance to those of Hatto, Wildruff, etc., but in which the rats make no appearance. In the 10th century, Iceland suffered severely from a bad year, so there was a huge amount of destitution throughout the country, and unless something were done by the wealthy bonders to relieve it, there was a certainty of many poor householders perishing during the approaching winter. Then Svafi, a heathen chief, stepped forward and undertook to provide for a considerable number of sufferers. Accordingly, the poor starving wretches assembled at his door and were ordered by him to dig a large pit in his tun, or home meadow. They complied with alacrity, and in the evening they were gathered into a barn, the door was locked upon them, and it was explained to them that on the following morning they were to be buried alive in the pit of their own digging. "You will at once perceive," said Svathi, "that if a number of you be put out of your misery, the number of mouse wanting food will be reduced, and there will be more victuals for those who remain." There was truth in what Svathi had said, but the poor wretches did not view the matter in the same light as he, nor appreciate the force of his argument, and they spent the night howling in despair. Thorwald of Asi, a Christian who happened to be riding by them towards dawn, heard the outcries and went to the barn to inquire into the signification. When he learned the cause of their distress, he liberated the prisoners and bade them follow him to Asi. Before long, Svathi became aware that his victim had escaped and set off in pursuit. However, he was unable to recover them as Thorwald's men were armed, and the poor people were prepared to resist with the courage of despair. Thus the golden opportunity was lost, and he was obliged to return home, bewailing the failure of his scheme. As he dashed up to his house, blinded with rage and regardless of what was before him, the horse fell with him into the pit which the poor folk had dug, and he was killed by the fall. He was buried in it the next day, along with his horse and his hound. In all likelihood, this Svathi was sacrificed in time of famine, and the legend may correctly describe the manner in which he was offered to the gods, that is, by burial alive. Okay, I'm going to skip a little bit here. That he feels that these sacrifices are made to Odin. Odin was the receiver of the souls of men, as Freya, or in German Holda, took care of those of women. Odin appears as the wild huntsman, followed by a multiple of souls, or as the piper of Hamelin, leading them into the mountain where he dwells. Freya, or Holda, leads an army of mice, and Odin a multitude of rats. As a rat or a soul god, it is not unlikely that sacrifices to him may have been made by the placing of the victim on an island infested by water rats, there to be devoured. The manner in which sacrifices were made have generally some relation to the nature of the god to whom they were made. Thus, Odin was a wind god, Men were hung in his honor. Most of the legends we are considering point to islands as the place where the victims suffered, and islands, we know, were regarded with special sanctity by the northern nations. Rügen and Heligoland and the sea were sacred from remote antiquity, and probably lakes had as well their sacred islets, to which the victim was rowed out, his back broken, and on which he was left to become the prey of the rats. We find rats and mice regarded as sacred animals in other Aryan mythologies. Yes, as mentioned before, in India, especially throughout India. Apollo was called Smintheus, as has been stated already, and some of the coin of Argos, in place of the god, is figured his symbol, the mouse. In the temple at Chrysa was a statue of Apollo with a mouse at his feet, and tame mice were kept as sacred to the god. In the Smintheon of Haximoxenus, white mice were fed as a solemn rite and had their holes under the altar, and near the tripod of Apollo was a representation of one of these animals. Among Semitic nations, the mouse was also sacred. Herodotus gives a curious legend relating to the destruction of the host, a senator before Jerusalem. Isaiah simply says, "Then the angel of the Lord went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000, and when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses." How they were slain he does not specify, but as the army was threatened with a hot blast and a destroying wind, it is rendered probable that they were destroyed by a hot wind. But the story of Herodotus is very different. He received it from the Egyptian priests, who claimed the miracle of which they had but an imperfect knowledge for one of their gods, and transferred the entire event to their own country. After Amoritus reigned the priest of Vulcan, whose name was Selthon, he held in no account and despised the military caste of the Egyptians as not having need of their services, and accordingly, among other indignities, he took away their lands, to each of whom, under former kings, 12 chosen acres had been assigned. After this, Sennacherib, king of the Arabians and the Assyrians, marched a large army against Egypt, whereupon the Egyptian warriors refused to assist him, and the priest, being reduced to a strait, entered the temple and bewailed before the image of the calamities he was in danger of suffering. While he was lamenting, sleep fell upon him, and appeared to him in a vision that the gods stood by and encouraged him, assuring him that he should suffer nothing disagreeable in meeting the Arabian army, for he would himself send assistance to him. Confiding in this vision, he took with him such of the Egyptians as were willing to follow him, and encamped in Pelusium, for there the entrance into Egypt is. But none of the military caste followed him, but tradesmen, mechanics, and sutlers. When they arrived there, a number of field mice, pouring in upon their enemies, devoured their quivers and their bows, and moreover the handles of their shields, so that on the next day, when they fled bereft of their arms, many of them fell. And to this day, a stone statue of this king stands in the temple of Vulcan with a mouse in his hand and an inscription to the following effect: "Whoever looks upon me, let him revere the gods." Oh, jeez. So, and wow, there's even more, but I'm going to leave it at that because that's a lot. So, what are we to gain from all these? What are we to gather from all these stories of rats and people? That people have felt so close to rats and mice over the years that they do see them as the idea that, like human souls, that they're, you know, the bearers of human souls on their way to other places. How common that is. I also mentioned sort of in passing that, particularly for people, that one of the reasons they would think that is they probably spent more time interacting with rats and mice than modern people do. You know, and we're more familiar with their habits and how they act. And they did probably, you know, regard them as inevitable, since they were around all the time. Anywhere you're storing food, you're certainly going to have mice and rats. That all these stories of the person being stripped down to a skeleton, clearly the mark, even in a folkloric way, of the divine intervention involved there, rather than sort of, you know, an observation of natural history, is that no animal ever, no mammal, like, would be, that was attacking a body and trying to eat it, would ever just strip it down to the skeleton. They would chew right through the bone. They'd probably go for the bone first. Typically, they go for the spine. I mean, because the marrow in the bone and the spinal fluid is probably the most nutritious thing in the, you know, the whole body. They certainly do not strip it down for, you know, museum-ready purposes. So you have a perfectly stripped, you know, skeleton. They would chew the bones to pieces. So if the rats and mice in these stories are, you know, chewing the person down to the skeleton, they are leaving the skeleton for a sign, aren't they? And again, I just think it's fascinating that people, that these, all these stories where rats are avenging injuries to humans, and they're seen as, you know, protectors and comrades. So next time you see Pizza Rat or one of his friends, why don't you give him a smile, eh? You know they're not afraid of you. You know, I keep telling you, I mean, it's weird, you know. Rats and mice really like people, you know. You'd think they'd take the, you know, they're not just going to let a couple of hundred years of people getting freaked out, you know, let them forget their true mission as friends to the human race. Don't believe me? Okay, fine, be that way. But what you should do, at any rate, even if you don't believe me, you should call 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Or go to WBAI.org and make a pledge. Make a pledge to keep this station on the air. Become a buddy. Donate $10 or more, as much as you can spare, as much as you feel comfortable doing. Don't strip yourself down to the bone, but we're going to be stripped down to the bone if we don't get some, help from some of y'all to give money. So just come, buddy, $10 a month or more. Comes out of your, you know, bank account, credit, debit. We get the money. You feel good. The station stays on the air. That's a win-win-win, right? So be a friend to your, once you time to see a rat, be a pal. Be a friend of the rat. Just give him a wink. He'll know what you mean. She will know what you mean. And I have, this is, I guess I should mention again, the book I've been reading to you from, the last thing, was Sabine Baring-Gould's Curious Myths of the Middle Ages, compiled from a number of sources, with the odd and charming prejudices of people who collected folklore in 1864. I will be back next week with more stuff. I think I probably will do Pied Piper of Hamelin next week with all the things that go along with that. Who am I? I'm Anne Marie Hendrickson. What is this show? A Mansion for the Rat. You're listening to WBAI-FM in New York City, 99.5, part of the Pacifica Radio Network. And certainly, you will want to stay tuned for the following program, The Dustbin of History with Max Schmid, and I'm afraid without me, for tonight. I'll be back next week. Don't you go anywhere. Pledge some money. Be a pal. Good night. The rest of the day, it sounds like it must have been some